You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 321.
On today's show, we talk about the many layers, both fact and fiction, of the ancient city of Troy.
Let's dig a little deeper into those strat facts.
Strat facts.
Welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 321.
Hello.
So, last week, we said we were excited about news stories.
Yeah, we did.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
We have all these cards in our Trello board for episodes we want to do, and we were just looking, and one of the ones that we had pretty much ready to go was about Troy, and it was one of our Strat Chat episodes.
Yeah, I think this might only be the second one we've done, or maybe the third. I think the second, where we are looking at like the stratigraphy of a single place because, you know, places have been occupied by people over many years and much time. So we thought it would be really cool to look at one place and all of the different occupation levels in it. And that's the stratigraphy that's there. And we're calling that Strat Chat. So that's what these shows are.
And we sort of start from current times and we go back in history.
Yeah. Which I have to say, it's like a little weird to talk about it going back in time because you're talking about the most recent level and then going back to the oldest level. And normally people talk about sites from oldest to newest.
Well, that's why this is called Strat Chat. Because when you dig archaeologically, you start with the newest and you move to the oldest.
Yeah, you got to like switch your brain to know that what we're talking about is going to get even older. And we're going to have the foundations of whatever we're looking at right now below that.
Yeah.
And that's how it is just doing archaeology. So it's kind of a more real look at what we do when we're in the field.
We're excavating history.
Excavating history. I love it.
Yeah. Maybe we'll rename the podcast that.
No, we won't.
No.
But yeah, okay. Troy is super cool. I had so much fun researching it today. I probably spent way more time on it than I should have. And that's why we're doing this rather than more news stories. We'll be back with those next week, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right. So, Troy. Everybody's probably heard of the Trojan War, the, you know, horse thing that the Trojan horse that people snuck into with. Those are some of the more famous things.
And stories.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But that's probably why people know it, right?
Yeah.
It's been in various movies and things like that. So
Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is what all of this is based on.
Right. Which a lot of people haven't read, but they're more probably familiar with movies and
Maybe like Trojan horse is kind of like just it's one of those phrases that you use in modern times. So there's just a huge mythological and story fictional history around this place. But as it turns out, there's actually a real place too, and sort of detangling what's fiction and what is real is not difficult necessarily, but you just have a lot of speculation that goes on, and it's kind of some fun speculation too, but it makes it a really interesting and different place than you have from most other archaeological sites, because those are just facts, right?
Yeah.
Troy is different because you have all this fictional history wrapped up in it too, so made it really fun to research and talk about.
All right, so where is Troy? It's located on the Mound of Hisarlik, which overlooks the plain along the Turkish Aegean coast, about 4.8 kilometers from the southern entrance to the Dardanelles.
Yeah, and so this first segment, we're talking about the top layer, where we're at right now, the modern history of the archaeological site of Troy. It has a long history of excavation, and it begins in 1870 with a German, let's put archaeologist in quotes, Heinrich Schliemann.
I mean, in 1870, this was an archaeologist.
Kind of, but like, let's keep moving.
Archaeology didn't gain its scientific footing until probably the end of the 1800s. But
it didn't, but there was getting close. Some people at that time, and I think Andrew at the Pseudo Archaeology Podcast has talked about some of these early pioneers. Some of them did a really good job of documenting everything from a scientific perspective. And others did what this guy did, which was blow through everything to get to treasure.
Yeah.
Like, he just crushed some perfectly stratified layers of settlement remains in his quest for treasure.
Well, a lot of these people back in this time frame were you know, gentlemen scholars, so to speak, that they had no real scientific training, but they had some sort of status within their society. And either A, they were the rich person that was out doing this, and they would use these artifacts to build up their own egos and their own importance, or B, they were being funded by somebody who was doing that through the things they were finding.
Right.
Yeah.
This guy is particularly interesting because he made a bunch of money in like gold speculation and indigo speculation in like Russia, I think I read, and like some other kind of shady business dealings. So he had a bunch of money and he was interested. And so he started working here. I mean, I guess it's great because he brought, you know, the focus of the world back to this place that had kind of been lost or forgotten, really. But he definitely did some damage on the way.
Yeah. Funny how they call it speculation. I speculate on a lot of things throughout the day. It doesn't make me a...
Are you making like gazillions of dollars through that speculating?
I'm really not.
Well, it's really disappointing.
Just, it's really just wasting a lot of my time.
Right.
Just spend the whole day speculating about not work. All right. So one of the things this guy's kind of known for, aside from being one of the early excavators of Troy, was that he found what he called Priam's treasure. And it's cache of goblets, shields, diadems, bracelets, necklaces, brooches, thousands of gold beads, hundreds of other objects, all made of gold, silver, copper, and electrum, which is a mixture of precious metals.
Yeah.
So this whole thing was just huge. And you can actually see this on display at the museum that's there now.
Some of it.
Some of it, yeah.
And there's more drama wrapped up in him because he was German and he took all this back to Germany, or a lot of it went back to Germany. Mm-hmm. And then it ended up in the hands of the Nazis, and then it went to Russia after Nazi was occupied. So a lot of it is actually in Russia right now, and they are not interested in handing any of that over. So there's a lot of drama around it, similar to the Elgin marbles, which we've talked about for Parthenon, but not as widely reported on, I think, because they just simply haven't been as loud about it.
Right.
Anyway, that's the brief early excavation story.
Yep. There have been about 24 excavation campaigns spread over the last 140 years, which isn't a lot. And they've revealed many features from all the periods of occupation in the citadel and the lower town.
Yeah.
And they've also been, you know, in recent years, using some cutting edge technology, including ground penetrating radar, which we've talked about, drones, of course, 3D mapping, which drones help with, but also still photography, and other traditional techniques.
Yeah. So that's great. It's definitely moving forward with archaeological technology, I guess. And then there's another important thing that they have going on, which is preservation at the site. There's tons of conservation projects everywhere. And that's partly to protect the site, but also to allow the visitors to enjoy the place and kind of imagine what it would have looked like. Like if you walk up to an archaeological site, you just see piles of dirt. Like it's really hard to understand what you're seeing, you know? So like a certain amount of reconstruction, rebuilding makes sense. And they've apparently done a very good job of that at the site.
Yeah, there's a visitor center museum on site now, showing off artifacts from all different eras of Troy, and gives you a sense of how much history there is there really. And there's even a, which I would really like to see, a replica of the Trojan horse built by Turkish craftsmen in the 1970s.
Yeah, I read in one article that like some people come to Troy and like literally take pictures with that horse and then leave.
Yeah.
Like they don't even like go experience more of it. Don't be a tourist like that.
Right.
But yeah, it sounds like it's a pretty big draw. They have tons of stuff going on, festivals, events. There's just clearly like a sense of pride about this place. Mm-hmm. And they put a lot of work and effort into making it a welcoming place for visitors. So that's great.
Yeah, it's a big part of Turkish heritage, too. And they talk about it in school curriculums. It's part of their national identity.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, interestingly, they've got a lot of stuff in Turkey.
Tons.
I once heard it described as the world's largest open air museum because of all the sites. Yeah. So the fact that they would, I don't know, sort of glom onto this as part of their national identity. I guess there's probably a lot of other things too, but isn't Çatalhöyük in Turkey? Yeah, we've talked about lots of times.
There's so much early human history in this place, so there's just so much. But Troy, I think, is a extra special place because of that intersection between the fictional place and the real place, and people are always trying to learn which pieces are real, what's the story, what was made up, when was it made up by Homer or somebody earlier or somebody later. So it's just that place of fascination for that reason.
Yeah, they're finding new stuff all the time there too as they keep digging down, like residential quarters, fortifications, ancient water systems. And there have been some pretty neat finds like inscriptions that help understand later periods in Troy and not just the Bronze Age, where there's likely fewer inscriptions,
the big stuff. Yeah. So with all the popularity is, you know, a bit of a balancing act, of course, as you can imagine. So they have a lot of visitors come every day. I think there's potentially thousands of visitors every day, but they have to allow those people in without also damaging the site.
Yeah.
And so they've done a lot of digital reconstructions and augmented reality type of things to give people a sense of the city without actually like damaging anything real. So that's another cool piece of modern technology they're bringing in.
Yeah, I'll have to see if Troy, it probably is in, I've got a couple of virtual reality apps for the Oculus that allow you to basically go in and walk around and see different ancient sites, basically, the way they are now. Yeah,
that would be cool. I bet Troy would be. It's such a like, it's such a well-known place and thing, you know?
Well, that was one of the cool things about Second Life back in the day.
Yeah.
And Second Life is still around as far as I know, but they really should have gone virtual, to be honest with you. But I think they just never did. And they kind of had a big thing against it for a while. But anyway, people would build these ancient sites in Second Life so you could go literally like walk around this digital recreation of something like this. So, yeah, there's a lot of cool reconstructions out there.
Yeah, I think today people are much more receptive to that kind of thing, too. Like as we move forward in virtual reality is an augmented reality is just becoming a bigger part of everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. I feel like it's just on the horizon of becoming, you know, the new thing with learning about these kind of places.
Yeah. One of the things that's difficult to do is separate myth from history within Troy, because there's so much myth wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
And one of the articles that we read said that guides sort of either lean into Homer and others stick to the facts.
Yeah.
So
don't know what you're going to get there.
Yeah. But there's probably a lot of, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to either of them. And you can't just go off the archaeological facts necessarily because there's no context there in some cases. Right.
And we only have what we have. Like whatever we don't have evidence for, we can't say, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. So.
And there's international collaboration, too, with universities, research teams, and even entire conferences all focused on Troy. So it's still a pretty major topic in the world. I wouldn't say it's at like Egypt level, but it's pretty high up there, depending on what part of the world you're in. And Troy is also one example of how archaeology can and legend can overlap. And that's a big part of its appeal.
You know, for sure.
I said, a lot of people have heard of Troy. They've heard of the myths and legends of Troy. And you can actually kind of go there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's it's super cool.
Yeah.
So one question that always comes up about Troy is this really Homer's Troy, the Troy that he wrote about in the Iliad and the Odyssey and all of that? And then all of the stuff that has come after that and it's based on his stories. Like, is this really it? So my thing was, I don't remember those stories at all. Like, I think I read the Odyssey in high school. Did you read either of them?
I read the Iliad.
You read the Iliad. Okay. Yeah. Do you remember it? It's been so long.
The way it's written, it's difficult to remember. You remember some of the stories,
like the basics.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I have here, and I actually pulled this directly from one of the articles that we will have in our show notes, but it's a like quick summary of the Iliad. It's from the Smithsonian article, just so that you can have a reminder of what the story is, because I definitely needed that.
Yeah.
And so they say, the epic poem describes in gory and lyrical detail 52 days near the end of the 10-year siege of Troy, the well-fortified city ruled by the kindly King Priam. According to the legend, Priam's son Paris, sometimes known in Turkey as Alexandros, ignited the war by seducing the lovely-haired Helen, wife of the Spartan king Menelaus, and spiriting her to the citadel at Troy. In response, Menelaus's brother Agamemnon, the king of kings, who ruled from Mycenae on the Greek mainland, led a fleet of warships across the Aegean to recapture Helen and take revenge against the city. That's a very basic boiled down, distilled version of the story.
If we ever had a kid, I would love to name him Agamemnon.
I was going to say Helen.
Well, for a girl, sure. Yeah, but Agamemnon, it's just like, come on, Aggie.
Oh, boy, that name sure is a mouthful. You're putting a lot on that kid right there.
Agamemnon Alexandros.
Oh, God. That's a lot.
There's got to be some Agamemnons over in...
I'm sure there are. I think there's probably some in this country.
There might be.
Yeah. That's great. Yep. Okay, so there's your basic primer on the story, if you don't remember from your high school days, like we did not.
Yeah, there's actually not a lot of evidence that anything that Homer mentioned happened the way he wrote it.
Yeah.
He wrote such vivid characters, dramatic battle scenes, and flawed heroes. All of it seems surreal, but in the end, it does seem like it is just a story. Yeah, which has driven, honestly, a lot of the search for the Trojan War like battle site.
But even though the characters and the people and the things that happen don't seem to be real, it does appear that this Troy is Homer's Troy. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of reasons. We're only going to list a couple here, and then we'll get to more of them in the next couple segments while we're talking more about the next stratigraphy, the next layer.
Yep.
But in the story, Troy is on a hill situated between two rivers, the Scamander and the Simois. And now there are modern scholars who suggest today that those two rivers correspond to the two rivers around the modern archaeological site of Troy as the Caramandarus and the Dumrec Sum. So we've got rivers in the right place. Check. Yeah. Great.
The Iliad also contains references to the mile-high Mount Ida, which is 20 miles to the south of Hisarlik, where Troy is currently located.
There you go.
And the Iliad is an important piece of literature. It seems like Homer was just setting his epic story in a real place and the rest is fictional. I mean, people do that all the time.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
You know, how many people in 1,000 years when everything might be disconnected from our current humanity are going to try to find Hogwarts Castle in England? Right. I mean, the books are everywhere right now.
That is so funny. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That is such a funny comparison. I never would have thought about that. Yeah. But like they write about it, like you can actually get there from London. And so everybody knows where London is. And sure, in 1,000 years, I'm sure they still will know where it is. So people might be like searching for the site of Hogwarts. Well, that would be so funny.
They'll be off the trail pretty quick when they can't find platform 9 3/4.
Yeah, that's true.
Or they find it in Florida, in Orlando.
Oh my gosh.
At Disney World.
The comparison I was thinking of is Forks. Washington. Forks,
Washington. Oh my God. Which is a real place.
A real place with a real people and real town that is absolutely nothing like the story of Twilight.
Yes.
Nothing like it.
Because Twilight was actually shot in Oregon.
Yeah, in like the rainforest basically in Oregon, which is not in Forks.
No.
So anyway, authors can take a place and turn it into whatever they want. Yeah. And Homer very well could have done that here.
Yes. So rewinding a little bit before modern times, we get to the Greek city of Leon, or it's L-L-I-O-N. I don't think it's...
Oh, Ilion. It's an I. It's Ilion.
Oh, it's a capital I.
Yeah, it's a capital
yes,
I.
Ilion.
Yeah.
Right. This seems to have been a place of pilgrimage for the Greeks in the late 8th or 7th centuries, early 7th centuries BCE. It was almost like a tourist site for visitors to pay their respects to the heroes of the past, like the ones written about by Homer.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? That this town got popular again because of a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it probably grew and had more people there because they went to see the heroes that he was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So
the town was mostly lost ish to time as Troy, but after the end of the Greek and Roman times in the 6th century CE, I mean, it was around, but it just never really flourished as a large settlement again. It just didn't have the same sway in the political arena.
All right, so when we get back on the other side, we're going to talk about the Bronze Age version of Troy and the Trojan War. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 321. Let's blast off.
Oh,
the Bronze
God.
Age City. Man, episode 321, we should have talked about like the archaeology
space
of
stuff.
Rockets.
Yeah.
There's no archaeology rockets.
There's not. No.
No. Yes.
Maybe in the future, but not now.
Unfortunately. Maybe fireworks. We could have done fireworks.
Mm,
yeah, because that goes back thousands of years in China.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So anyway, we're going to come back a few stratigraphic layers. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to go deeper in time, as archaeologists do, and talk about Troy during the late Bronze Age. And this is where things really start to get interesting.
Yeah. And this would be Troy 6 and 7. And there's a couple occupations after this, too, which we didn't really discuss. Those were mostly like the Greek occupation stuff like this. But for what we're going to talk about today, 6 and 7 is roughly 1700 to 1200 BCE in the late Bronze Age. And if there is a time period with a Trojan War and the Troy of Homer, then this would be it, probably. It's the right time period. It's the right place, right city, everything.
By the way, we didn't plan on saying 6, 7.
You know, I doubt
anyone.
In case any 12-year-olds are listening. You just...
In case any parents that have 12-year-olds are listening.
Yeah, a whole pile of millennials and Gen Xers just went, oh God, seriously, why did they have to say that?
Well, I'm bringing it back up because this isn't like the 6th or 7th version of Troy. Archaeologists will sort of designate eras within, stratigraphically within an archaeological dig or a site or something that has a lot of history associated with it, just so they can break things up.
Yeah.
So they'll figure out what defines these levels. And, you know, sometimes like you hear about in North America here, you'll have the woodland period and the, you know, the mound period and things like that. They'll talk about things in those sorts of ways. Well, you have the Bronze Age and the Late Bronze Age and things like that, and broken up within that and around that and outside of it would be the versions of Troy culturally and technologically. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what is defining the Troy 6 and Troy 7 yeah. as we go through.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So at this time, the city was very much fortified. We've got massive stone walls, some of them as thick as 5 meters. And there are towers and gates everywhere. They would have been super impressive and very much a defensive
yeah.
city place.
Yeah, one unique feature is that the sections of the walls are slightly offset every 10 meters or so in order to curve around the site without the necessity for corners, which was kind of genius.
Yeah, because yeah. I guess corners would be weak points, basically.
Well, they could be
considered weak points. Yeah.
They're also harder to make.
A siege. They're harder to make. They're probably harder to maintain, too. So, yeah. like, everything about them is harder. So they just sort of gently curved.
That being said, I feel like somebody could parkour up a 90-degree angle of stone. So,
with all their armor on?
I mean, they only need to send one guy up there to throw a rope down. He's a sacrificial dude. So,
yeah.
The walls included 5 gateways allowing entrance to the inner city, or citadel, composed of large structures. The style with a central court and colonnaded halls is similar to those of contemporary Mycenaean cities such as Tiryns, Pylos, and Mycenae itself.
Yeah, and then outside of the citadel area is what they call the lower city, and that sprawls out over a huge area around the citadel, and it contains the workshops, the houses, the streets, all of the buildings associated with the sort of working yeah. population of this city.
Yeah. Archaeologists found evidence of multi-story houses and what looks like pretty advanced urban planning for the time, with yep. as many people that lived here, even at this time, you would have had to have had some thought to it. Otherwise, chaos.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And of course, there's tons of storage space, granaries, pits, that kind of thing. So clearly they're a hub of trade and they're probably pretty wealthy because they're able to stock away food for later, you know, whenever they might need it.
Right. Pottery from Mycenaean Greece, Cyprus, and beyond shows up here. So Troy was also a trade hub, probably by both land and sea, given its location.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more in the next segment, but yeah.
And I do have to mention, you probably can't hear this, but we can, and it's highly distracting, but our neighbors down here in this RV park in Mexico literally just brought home a 9-week-old Doberman puppy. They raise and show Dobermans, and they just picked him up from the States and brought him down here, and he's losing his mind in the RV next to us.
I don't know what he's barking at, but he's very excited about something.
He's such a cute little guy, too. Yeah. So. All right, well, back to Troy. I'm sure they had their own dogs. Yes. But there's also weapons that have been found, bronze swords, arrowheads, all the gear you'd expect if there was a conflict, or even just a large defensible city.
Yeah, like even if they didn't have a lot of conflict, you still need to have this stuff yeah. just in case. So, yeah. In addition to that kind of artifacts, they have also found exotic goods like amber and glass artifacts, which, you know, suggest Troy that was part of big trade networks, probably coming mm-hmm. in from Asia. Maybe coming in from over in the Aegean and over to Greece. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But definitely some big trade going on.
Burial customs from this area include tumuli and rich grave goods, hinting at a society with clear social hierarchies. So like mm-hmm. any bigger city state, I would say yeah. they definitely had their hierarchical burying methods. And speaking of size, population estimates put Troy at this time at several thousand people, some estimates up to 10,000. During its peak, which is pretty good size for that time in that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about how there was a citadel area and then there was kind of the lower city where we had more working class type people living. So there is a clear distinction between these elite homes and then the more modest dwellings. And they do tend to be split between those two places, too. You have your palaces and your places of worship and stuff like that up in mm-hmm. the citadel, and then the smaller, more family size homes down below.
Yeah, some of the animal bones found nearby tell us a little more about diet and feasting, and there's evidence of both everyday meals and special sacrificial events on site. And so, everything here.
Yeah, and I think in particular there was sheep, for sure. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of both sheep for food and also for textile production. So there's right. a lot of that.
So during this time, they're talking about the Trojan War possibly being at this time, and there are some signs that point to that. The city was maybe under siege, which mm-hmm. is the crux of the Trojan War. They were under siege for 10 years. There's signs of food storage, upgraded fortifications, and a lot more.
So, you know, you've got big questions, two big questions, really, when you're talking about Troy, especially in this time period, which is, quote unquote, Homer's Troy. This is the period that he was talking about mm-hmm. in the story. And those questions are, was there an actual Trojan War? And two, why was it abandoned or mostly abandoned, right?
Yeah.
And those are your two things that we're trying to answer. And we wish we could answer them, but we can't really answer either of those questions, but yeah. We're going to try.
Yeah.
But we'll start with the Trojan War. Was it real or made up? There's some cool evidence here, like really cool evidence.
Yeah.
So there is a Hittite tablet, and the Hittites were another culture, kind of, I don't know, they were nearby, mm-hmm. not close enough that they were part of the same culture, but close enough that they could have alliance, friendship, conflict, all the things that come along with that proximity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Hittite tablet dating to 1200 BCE. It mentions a relationship between the Hittites and a city named Wilusa. And there's speculation that Wilusa was just another name for Troy.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that being that Wilusa sounds a little bit like Ilios. It's a little bit of a stretch.
It's another word for Ilios.
But yeah, but it could be another word for Ilios. That's possible, yeah. Right? And Ilios, as we talked about earlier, is the Greek name for Troy.
Is Wilusa also another word for Wakanda? Just curious.
So is Troy Wakanda?
I
don't know about that. Yeah. So there is even on this tablet or a different one, there's a couple tablets at play in this whole story here, but there is mention of a Wilusan ruler who signed a treaty called Alexandru or Alexandros. And if you've been following along with our history here, Alexandros is another name for the Trojan prince Paris in Homer's poem. I don't know why everybody has so many different dang names. I think it just comes from different translations in different languages and different whatever.
Yeah.
But Alexandru, Alexandros, Paris, same person.
Yeah, it's interesting because Paris, I don't think, was a super common name back then. But Alexandros probably was.
Probably.
Yeah. So the fact that there's an Alexandros in this other city, I don't know if that's, I don't know how solid
a
that really is.
A ruler named Alexandros.
Well, sure.
Though.
But I mean.
But yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he Alexandros the Great?
Not yet.
He probably wasn't.
A little too early for that one. Okay. And so then the final piece of this puzzle is that there are other Hittite tablets that record several wars that took place in Wilusa during the late Bronze Age, which is this time period. And it seems like there was, from those tablets, there was a Hittite-Wilusa alliance. And so the speculation is maybe one of those conflicts that we know happened, because they're mm-hmm. documented on these tablets, were the Trojan War, essentially. Yeah. But yeah, there's your evidence for
Indeed.
A Trojan War that may have happened.
Right.
There's other evidence, too, like you said.
Yeah. But I mean, either way, this was a well-fortified city.
Yeah.
It probably had various conflicts over the years of occupation, because cities do.
Yes.
Especially back then.
Yeah.
And one of those wars may have been talked about or written about and influenced Homer to write the Iliad.
Yeah.
And it would be shocking if the Trojan War didn't get discussed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. Troy fell into ruin at the end of the Bronze Age around 1180 BC, as did all the centers of power of the Mediterranean world, for reasons that are really not that well understood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as to why this could have happened, we don't know exactly, but there is some evidence. The lower city contains a 13-foot wide defensive trench that's dug straight into the bedrock, right?
Yeah.
And interestingly, here's another little Homer piece of evidence. It matches Homer's description of, and here's in quotes from, I think, the Iliad, a dike being everywhere so deep and set with stakes exceeding thick, sharp, strong, that a horse could never pass, much less their chariots after them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I guess a ditch in the ground doesn't, there's not only one place in the world that has a ditch in the ground for a fortification, mm-hmm. but it, you know, more evidence, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's that ditch. And then the lower city at some point expanded to that defensive trench, which was well outside of town at first. And they had to construct a second one outside of it to accommodate the city continuing to expand.
Right.
And the reason why this might show conflict or a reason why the city was under siege or a reason for abandonment later on was that this indicates that people rapidly moved into the town from outside areas, possibly to take refuge from whatever was going on. And then this might have effectively like brought the end of the town as we know it.
Yeah. If there really was 10 years of the siege of Troy.
Yeah.
It would have been difficult in modern times to maintain supply chains and things like that to keep people alive inside the fortifications of the city for even a few months.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they possibly went 10 years, if that's to be believed, then not only would that have been a monumental feat, but it would have probably destroyed everything around the city and made it almost uninhabitable mm-hmm. once the war was over, regardless of who won.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally. And then in addition to that size of the city and the placement of these ditches, there's some evidence of fire damage as well. And so it could have been a big fire that mm-hmm. ran people out. Maybe that fire was caused by an earthquake. There also is potentially a little bit of evidence of that. But nobody's really sure. Don't know. But yeah. Effectively, people had moved on from this city. The large portion of people had moved on from the city by 1180.
Yeah, if you can see evidence of fire damage in the archaeological record, chances are that was a occupation ending event, because if it wasn't, they'd have cleaned it up and we wouldn't see evidence of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Right. Yeah, totally.
So, all right. Well, we are going to take a health and safety break, and then as mandated by OSHA here in the United States, and then we're going to continue our excavation. Well, we're going to continue our excavation into the lower layer. This is Strat Chat, if you remember.
It is Strat Chat. Yes. And we are working hard with our trowels.
Yeah, we're going to go in the car, take the hard hat off for a little while.
Oh, you my know? God. I need a trowel sound, a scraping trowel sound to be our sound for the end of these segments.
You are scraping on my brain right now for trowel sounds. All right. We'll be back in a little bit to talk about the very first origins of Troy. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 321, and this is a Strat Chat with Troy.
Why are you saying it like like a radio show from the 90s?
Welcome to Strat Chat.
Like 1 a.m.
Welcome to Strat Chat, where we dig through the layers.
Okay, I have to go back to what I said at the end of the last segment. I really want the sound of a trowel scraping over dirt. And so if anybody's out there working in the field and wants to record themselves doing that, I would really love to have that sound.
I'm not sure what this is doing on my microphone right now. I think it's like, a trowel, though.
I was like thinking I could take my like metal spatula outside and like scrape the dirt. That would pretty much sound like that.
We have
right?
an actual trowel.
We have one with us?
Sure. We're archaeologists.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. All right, well... trowel scraping sounds incoming at some point.
All right, then. Okay, so let's go all the way back to Troy 1. So when we talk about our numbering system for city states and things like this, the number 1 is always the oldest one.
Yeah.
Which is problematic if you end up digging deeper and find other stuff, then you can renumber everything.
Yeah.
But chances are they wouldn't have started numbering these things until they were pretty solid on the timeline.
Yeah. For the sake of not confusing ourselves further, since we're going backwards in time, we're talking about 1 through 5 in this final segment, but we're just going to do those in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 right now in this 15-minute segment or whatever it is. So.
Yeah. But Troy 1 was roughly 3000 to 2550 BCE. So that's a long time ago, over 5,000 years in the early Bronze Age. Now, remember in the last segment, we were in the late Bronze Age. The Bronze Age is a fairly long period of time. Mm-hmm. So, but you can picture a small village on a hill surrounded by wide open plains, not quite the metropolis that it was in the last segment.
Yeah. And the citadel area that we talked about in the last segment, it would have been just that area. And it certainly wouldn't have had the large buildings, the big fortifications, none of that. It would have just been a small kind of compound on a hill. Mm-hmm. So today the city is 5 kilometers from the ocean or from the Dardanelles Straits.
Yeah.
But at the time it would have been right on the water or very close to the water, close enough that it was reachable from ships out in the water. And because of that proximity to the ocean, it would have been perfect for trading by both land and sea.
By the way, it's not the ocean, it's the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, it is. Right. Sorry. I use ocean and sea interchangeably. So
you do that in front of our RV right now.
Yes, I do. I call this the ocean right here.
Yes.
Is it not?
Well, you know, it's an extension of the ocean, but it's more specifically a sea.
That water right there touched the ocean, though, didn't it?
Yes. It did.
So it's the ocean.
Yes. Lots of rivers touch the
logic,
ocean, too.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
I call rivers rain.
Welcome back to Geography for the Insane. No. So, all right. So, as you mentioned, Troy is the entrance at the entrance to the Dardanelles Strait, which is the main connection between the Aegean Sea and the Black Sea. And ships often had to wait here for days waiting on weather to pass through the strait, because straits can be pretty catastrophic for ships. I'm sure there are a number of shipwrecks down there.
Yep. Very windy.
So even in these earliest days, people were building fortifications, stone foundations with mud, brick, and walls on the top just to defend themselves.
Yeah. And they have found pottery and metal that match things that are on the island of Lesbos and Lemnos in the Aegean, and then also other places in northern Anatolia. And so that indicates that trade was already going on in kind of a big way, because those places are pretty far from both Troy and from each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these ships coming in was really causing a lot of trade, which probably created this early prosperity that we're seeing.
Yeah, and these early Trojans were actually working with copper and bronze already. So they were starting to get heavy into metalworking,
mm-hmm.
which is, I mean, they had to because they had just entered the Bronze Age. And one of the qualifications is you start doing metalworking.
You work with metal.
Yes. So they're like, ah, crap, we're in the Bronze Age now. So
guess we got to do that metal thing.
Guess we got to figure it out. So,
yeah.
All right.
So their diet was pretty diverse at this time. Sheep, goats, cattle, pigs. So in addition to those, they would have had cereals, legumes, fish, game, all kinds of different things. What you would expect to see in an emerging economy like this.
Right. Their social organization is a little harder to pin down, but the evidence suggests small clan-based communities. And it's harder to pin down because, well, there was probably no writing, or at least none that survived.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to sort of talk about that. But we do have a lot of examples of very similar societies around the world, and especially around that area. And you mm-hmm. can kind of make some inferences based on what they had.
Yeah, definitely. Now, their burial practices were inhumations, which is whole body interments.
Mm-hmm.
And they did have grave goods, too. So you've got a little bit of an idea there. I mean, they were at least advanced enough that they had an afterlife mm-hmm. process that they were trying to appeal with their
gods.
Burial practice.
And burials.
Yeah.
Sorry, so you thought you were trying to say they were going to appease their gods.
No,
but I mean, well, that really is what they were doing.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. By about 2550 to 2300 BCE, this area had transitioned to what we call Troy II and had strong walls encircling a citadel that was still relatively small but very prosperous on top of the hill. So having walls like this long ago was starting to get pretty impressive.
Yeah. And clearly it's related to all the trade that was going on there because there were so many ships that came through this area. I didn't realize it was such a crossroads for mm-hmm. kind of east meets west a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's why that there's a wide range of artifacts that we find at this site too, kind of through all the time periods. Because from the second that trade started between east and west, you know, they stopped here. They almost had to because of weather half the time. So very interesting.
Yeah, if you remember Prime's treasure from segment one, this was found by Heinrich Schliemann and dates to Troy II, so where we're at now. So mm-hmm. it didn't actually date to when he would have lived.
Homer's Troy. Yeah.
But it suggests a period of wealth and prosperity because of what was found in that treasure.
Yeah.
As well as showing trade happening with Asia, as did other artifacts.
Yeah, because we talked about, you know, quote unquote, Troy's Homer in the last segment. And this is like 1,000 years before that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they found the treasure 150 years ago or whatever it was and declared Troy. Like, mm-hmm. we found it. Look at all these rich goods. But like, yes, Troy was rich too. The Troy of Homer. But this was also, I mean, it started way earlier than that, I guess, is what I'm saying, mm-hmm. which is another just little interesting tidbit about the area.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily wrong.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the Troy that people were thinking of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You also have storage facilities that show up at this time, which means they were thinking ahead about food security. So if you've got a large populace to maintain, first off, not everybody is out there harvesting and doing mm-hmm. their own thing. When you start to get bigger, people have other specialties.
Yep.
And they also need to eat through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And you just can't harvest throughout the winter. So you, if you're a big enough city state, you have to have food storage and food preservation.
Yeah. And that's shown with this next point too, which is the specialized crafts. They mm-hmm. have ceramics, weaving, metalwork. So people weren't all just out there farming. And that's why there was probably food storage so that, you know, people like the craftsmen were able to go out and buy what they needed.
Yeah. There are also some administrative marks and seal impressions. So markings of public officials and agents and things like mm-hmm. that suggest early forms of record keeping, which is starting to get also pretty detailed when you have a big society like this.
Mm-hmm. So the fortifications throughout this time just keep getting bigger and better. And that shows that defense, of course, was always front and center for these guys. Yeah. Again, probably because where they were positioned on the water, which is easy access for sailors, but also easy access for anybody who might want to invade them.
Well, it sounds like they were pretty rich and powerful overall as a city state. And, you know, they're going to get people wanting that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. What's so funny, though, is that, yes, they themselves, this contained city-state was rich and prosperous, but they never branched out.
Mm-hmm.
They never had a ruler who wanted to go take over everything around them and make a larger city-state like you see in these other places and other kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, they stayed very contained and very, I guess, content with what they had, where they were.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, which might explain why they didn't last, ultimately.
Yeah, that's true.
Nowhere to go.
And they, like, as prosperous as they were probably from the archaeological record, they didn't make a huge impact on like global history as a whole, except for the fact that they were a place that sailors stopped on the way, you know, east and back again.
Honestly, if it wasn't for Homer, we probably wouldn't
have no idea.
Yeah, they'd be just another archaeological site.
Yep, the city would be any number of other cities that you stop at when you're on your way to and from somewhere on a shipping adventure.
Yeah, another sign of a large city-state is spirituality. And there's plenty of ritual objects that have been found, including figurines and altars. And they hinted at spiritual life and community gatherings. And again, that is another feature of larger societies that are starting to organize.
Mm-hmm. There are some signs of conflict, and there's weapons, of course, remains of weapons. And then there's also damage to some of the fortifications that show up in the archaeological record as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Troy's connections to the wider early Bronze Age world are clear in the material culture. So the trade we've talked about, things like that, their technology, all that.
Yeah, for sure. And also like the presence of pottery from Asia and stuff like that, and things from over in Mycenae and Greece.
Yeah.
They didn't manufacture that stuff. It came to them. So obviously some kind of trade was going on there.
Yeah. And while we're talking about this permanent existence, so to speak, over several thousand years, but then eventual abandonment, the city did go through other cycles of abandonment and rebuilding, which they're saying in some articles that it shows resilience and adaptability. But I'm like, yeah, until that last time.
Until the last one. But even then, it wasn't a full abandonment. It never was, not until like maybe 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
But there's just times of more people and less people, probably depending on what was going on in the larger world and whether or not there was a lot of trade going on in this area and stuff like that.
Yeah. So even at this early stage, Troy had a strategic location, like we've said, and that was pretty obvious with the goods that have been found there. And controlling trade and movement across the region was important to them and important to their success.
Mm-hmm. And all of those different layers set the stage for the Troy of Homer, the Troy of legend. And by the time Homer was telling these stories, this city already had a long and complex history, which is probably another reason why he picked it, right? He experienced Troy and learned about all of this great history that it had. And he kind of wrapped all that up into the story that he created that has lasted until today, which is so crazy. It's a 3,000-4,000-year-old story.
Yeah.
3,000-year-old story, and people are still reading it today.
Yeah, so Troy 3 through 5, which is next, went through about, you know, a little over 1,000 years worth of smaller occupations and seemed less prosperous. Who knows why? That seems like a really long time even to be located in the same spot where the world is getting more populous. Mm-hmm. And yet right here, in the archaeological record anyway, it seems like they were less prosperous with smaller occupations, which is very interesting how that sort of ebbs and flows.
It is interesting. There's a couple cool excavation maps. There's definitely one in the Smithsonian article. I think the other articles have it too, but they kind of layer on top of each other in different colors, each of these stratigraphic layers, so that you can see 1 through 9, I think is the last one, right on top of each other. And 3, 4, and 5 are practically on top of each other and are on top of 2 as well, I think. So you had to go through those to get to 2. And a bit of the story here is that a lot of those layers were destroyed by the earlier, let's call them excavations in quote, but they were really just more treasure hunting, which you have to forgive a little bit because 150 years ago, they just didn't really know what they were looking for. They didn't have the same attention to detail. Like a stone is just a stone back then. It wasn't necessarily a rock wall or whatever today. But anyway, only give them a little bit of grace for that. Not a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that while the texts do say, you know, they had to dig through these layers to get to the really cool stuff, or so it seems.
Yeah.
If they're even saying that back in the late 1800s, when people are doing these excavations, and even the early 1900s, probably, I mean, if they are trying to get to what they're thinking is the cool stuff, there probably is something to that. You know, there was less of the bronze and gold and silver artifacts probably in those layers for them to be concerned with.
Yeah, they just didn't stop there. So there wasn't much to find.
Right. So even though we don't have necessarily the scientific record of those excavations, it's probably some significant truth to that. There wasn't a whole lot to see there.
Yeah, and I think they have the fill, too, from that area.
Sure. Which often has really fun stuff for archaeologists.
That's true, but it's like out of context, too. So you might have these three, you know, 3, 4, and 5 kind of all jumbled up together, and you don't know what goes with what. But if you don't have any of the like more outstanding artifacts that you found, you know, outstanding in quotations and by, you know, what your preference is, gold and silver, I guess, then, you know, you can assume that they just weren't as prosperous at that point. But the question is why?
Yeah.
And you don't get to know the answer to that question without a fully articulated, you know, stratigraphy, which we don't have, not really for that area.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost 1300 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Like some stuff happened. It had to have.
Yeah.
And it, there could be places that are not excavated yet that can fill in this picture more, because there is more excavating to do here. There always is on these kind of sites. So maybe they will fill in this picture a little bit better as they do more excavation. But for right now, we only know what we know.
It could have been a series of ruling families, too, with long lineages and descendant hierarchies that, I mean, really just weren't concerned with expansion, growth, anything like that, which means things are going to kind of fall off a bit.
Stay the same. Yeah.
So,
well, there's also the possibility that weather kind of changed, or the shipping route changed in such a way that there wasn't as much traffic through that area. There's a lot of reasons why the shipping route might have either fallen off in popularity or changed or something like that. And just all of a sudden people weren't really hanging out there.
Yeah.
And so the city decreases, it diminishes because there's not as much trade and not as much activity.
All right. Well, that's it for Stretch Ed. We've hit the bottom and it's time to go write the report.
Hit the sterile level.
That's right. So yeah, this podcast has hit the sterile level. So, all right. So we, so we will actually be back with news next time because there is still a lot to talk about.
Always.
Yep. Lots of good things. Mm-hmm. We just really wanted to do this one because we had it ready to go.
Oh, so. It's just so fun. It's making me want to read the Iliad and the Odyssey. And, oh my God, I downloaded a book, which I haven't even told you about yet. So I'll talk about it really quick. Again, I got this from a recommendation in one of the articles I read, but there's a series by Stephen Fry called Mythos. At least the first book is called Mythos, I think. And then there's at least four more books. And anyway, so I got that one for us to listen to when we're driving. Maybe we'll have to talk about it on the show after we listen to it. But it's all about the mythology and stuff. And Troy is featured heavily in, I think, the third book. So I don't know how long it'll take us to get there, but it'll be a fun one.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.